We acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land throughout Australia and recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging.
We were affected by the Kurrung fires. They started up probably 2 months before they actually got here. Fire brigade on the day of the fire were basically just going along Talwood M Road watching it. And the fire, when it came over the mountain at the back here, the flames were 100 metres high. On the day of the fires, we evacuated and stayed the night in Goulburn.
How was that like to lock the door behind you and walk away?
It was, we didn't get much sleep then. It was a bit of a surreal experience, really. Yeah.
This is the Big Shift for Small Farms podcast. G'day listeners, I'm your host Edgars Grester. According to the dictionary, bushfires, floods and other emergency events are defined as serious, unexpected and often dangerous situations requiring immediate action. That's why in this episode we're talking about emergency management. We'll hear from field officers and researchers about making plans and keeping yourself in check. And we'll talk to a farmer who's using animals as a tool to reduce his fire risk. So let's get planning.
Everything was black, like everything was black. There was a burnt out National Parks vehicle on the road, which was totally gutted. All the power poles were down. A lot of the scrub was still on fire. There were power lines across the road. It was pretty confronting.
That's Kirsty Hambrook from Terrawa Farm in Kangaroo Valley, New South Wales. And we heard from her husband, Andrew, at the top of the episode. Their 100-acre property was surrounded by the Currawarne fire front that came through Kangaroo Valley in early 2020. But luckily, their home survived the blaze.
All of our buildings had been saved, which was miraculous, really, considering there was no one here to defend it. No fire brigade could access this area.
Can you sort of talk me through what it was that you think, on reflection, was what saved your property?
It was planning, 100% planning. Before we even settled on this property, we asked about the history of the land, and we were told, oh, it was a pine plantation. And then in the 60s, a big fire came through from the west and wiped out all of the pine plantations. Then they rebuilt the pine plantation, and in the 80s, another big fire came through and wiped out the pine plantation. So we knew at that point that we were overdue for one of these big fires. We were building our house at a time that was after the Black Saturday fires in Victoria, so the Royal Commission had been handed down and building regs were tightened. So we were building at a time where it was really, government was very aware of, you know, we were in a designated bushfire zone, we knew the history of the property, and between that knowledge and our own desire not to burn alive in our beds, the building regs really were life-saving. The other saving grace in Kangaroo Valley was the personnel here. So our ex-fire captain in the area started up some community meetings, and he brought us all together and basically told us how it was. He said, if you want to stay and defend your property, that's your right. He said, you will not be able to defend any property unless you have two able-bodied, fit, mentally strong people. He said, you won't be able to communicate. He said, the roar of the fire will be so loud that you won't hear each other. Wow. There'll be no communication. You have to know what you're going to do, who's going to do what, and how it's going to play out before that fire comes. He said it would turn day to night, and he was right. It's exactly what happened. He said the heat would come through at approximately 1500 degrees Celsius, so there was zero chance of anyone being alive outside, that you'd have to shelter and you'd have to have a safe place to shelter, and that the half an hour after the fire front has come through was really when you did the work, was really when you saved your property. So he laid it out in pretty stark terms, and a lot of people at that meeting who had said they were going to stay and defend realised they needed to leave.
Everyone had a fire plan, but that meeting brought out that a lot of the fire plans that people had were actually flawed. And after that meeting, after the discussion groups, people went home and actually changed their fire plan. A lot of people that were going to stay and defend actually left, and I think they're alive today because of that. So it's one thing to have a fire plan, but it has to be a good fire plan. And a lot of the guys around here had flawed fire plans, yeah.
Hi, my name is Linda Hanlon. I'm a Senior Land Services Officer with Greater Sydney Local Land Services. As a part of the role as a Local Land Services Officer, it also includes emergency management. Each officer in the Penrith office, where I am located, they are on their own local emergency management committee in the local government area that they live.
What's your advice for people who are in those peri-urban areas to think about when it comes to planning for any kinds of emergencies? You know, what's the sort of one big first thing that they might want to think about doing?
Knowing where they are in the landscape, knowing what emergency event is going to actually happen to them. Obviously, the Hawkesbury Nepean is quite flood prone. The outskirts of the Hawkesbury, where I live, is fire prone. So I guess it depends where you're actually located, and you've just got to be prepared. There are so many resources out there now on the Rural Fire Service page and on the SES page that you can actually say, for example, on the SES page, you can go onto their interactive map and see where you are and see how a flood, what sort of flood might actually impact your property. And being prepared and talking about with your family as to what sort of animals you've got, what mix of animals you've got, and what are you going to do if a particular hazard or emergency event actually affects you.
Thinking about a plan, is it just one, or is it about having multiple plans as well? And obviously plans for different types of emergency events. Obviously in the Hawkesbury, you're in this kind of zone where you've got both fire and flood potential. What's your advice in terms of plans and how many to have and how regularly to update them?
It's probably good to have a couple of plans. One, if you're affected by flood, and if you're affected by fire, having both. But I think practicing it at least every year at the beginning of each, like fire season, for example, knowing and going through it in your head, preparing your house, preparing your family, and having that discussion with your family about what you're going to do in a particular time, where you're going to go, how are you going to get there, and what are you going to take. Though it's sort of this sort of how, what, when, where thing where you've got to actually answer each of those items. Another thing is if you go out to work, a lot of the Hawkesbury residents actually leave the local government area and go out to work. What happens if your road's closed off before you get home? Do you have a neighbour or some sort of buddy system in place that know your animals, that know what you want to do, so they can actually act for you? You don't want someone who's actually in the same situation as you and they've got to get their own animals out, but you've got to have someone else who might be able to do your job for you if you're not there. Or, you know, if you know there's going to be something happening, maybe you work from home that day. You don't go out of the local government area. If the RFS or the SES are giving you warnings ahead of time, you go, yeah, I might not leave the district today. I might just stay at home and just sort of assess what's happening. So there's lots of different things to think about. So having that buddy plan in place is probably a good idea as well.
If you think about an analogy of sport, right, we do practice and training, and when you're practiced, you feel more confident, ready to go on the field. And I guess the same rules would apply for this kind of thing, in that if you practice things, then you're going to be more prepared for when the real event happens.
Absolutely. It's a training for an event, and in that particular emergency event, the anxiety and the stress tend to take over a little bit, and then you forget what you need to do. So you've got to actually have something sort of set in place and almost second nature, so you know each member of your family has a job to do and they know, yep, this is what we've got to do. We've got to get our grab-and-go tubs out of the garage. We've got to, you know, pack the car, get the animals in, those sorts of things. So the stress and the anxiety levels tends to make things a lot slower almost, because you're like a headless chicken, I guess. You're sort of worried about how quick you've got to get out of there in the situation. So having that plan of attack and knowing what you've got to do, and each member of the family knows what they've got to do, then it helps dramatically. Yeah,
that's important, isn't it, realizing that, you know, when you're in a family situation, that you may know the plan, but making sure that everybody else knows the plan and what their role is and what their job is to do.
A couple of years ago when we first started the animal working group, and I thought it'd be really good to get kids involved with their parents in making a plan. So a small pet passport, a colouring book for kids, and it's been taken on, and is, you can see that on the SES website in educational resources. And I know it's been pushed a little bit more recently on Facebook, which is I'm pretty chuffed about. But it's a great resource. A lot of parents are actually giving it to their teachers, sending the info to their teachers so they can actually have the kids in classes involved in a colouring in book, where you think about what sort of animals have you got, What do you need to take with them? What are their names? Just easy things that kids will enjoy doing. Even there's a couple of pages for them to draw where their property is. Draw their house. Are they near the bush or are they near a river? So they can sort of see, yep, a river might be something that might affect my animals, and these are the sorts of animals I've got. There could be dogs, cats, horses, goats, pocket pets, you know, alpacas, you name it. It's sort of included in this little booklet with some resources in the back that parents can also look at to help with getting more information.
And, you know, kids are so observant. Having more people thinking about the plan, you'll have different perspectives, which is obviously really valuable. But also I get that the question of anxiety can be removed if, you know, if kids have some sort of agency where they feel like, oh, there's something that I can do to be a bit more prepared as well.
Yes, exactly. They feel like they're involved in the process, not just told to get in the car. They can actually be involved with getting their pet ready and helping mum and dad. I think that's really important. It gives them a job to do so they don't worry so much.
Whilst having a plan can help us be mentally prepared, emergency events can get the better of our emotions, and how we respond is really important. Mel Taylor is an associate professor at Macquarie University, and as a project leader in the Bushfire and Natural Hazards Cooperative Research Centre, she's interested in how we respond to large-scale risks like bushfire, floods and pandemics.
Like many experiences, there is an element of practice and rehearsal. So I think if you are prepared, if you're someone who's faced a number of challenges or even emergency situations, there's possibly a chance you might be calmer. But I think in general, although we can be quite practical and focused, you can't completely rule out your emotions and your emotional response.
Often in times of stress, we're not thinking clearly. And so having the physical plan, you know, the different scenarios for different options can enable us to be more proactive than reactive, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. Certainly just drawing it back to academic sort of theory just for a moment and not trying to bamboozle people too much. But in the theoretical areas here around protective behaviour, of which, you know, preparedness would be a protective behaviour against, you know, a hazard. We talk about the threat perception element or the threat appraisal, and we talk about the coping appraisal. And coping appraisal is all about how you manage that emotionally and practically as well. So a core part of that is self-efficacy. So self-efficacy is really important in terms of feeling that you are able to deal with something. And sometimes if you get overwhelmed by the threat and you don't feel you can cope, that's when people then go into what we call maladaptive behaviours, which includes fatalism, helplessness, a sense of wishful thinking, those sorts of things, which is really unhelpful in terms of actually addressing the problem. To go back to your main question about the preparedness component, you know, having checklists, having a strategy for what you'll do in certain circumstances, having a few different options so that you have that flexibility when you need it. Also, I think if you're the sort of person that can reflect on how you've overcome challenges in the past, that can be really helpful from a point of view of, I guess, that personal resilience. If you can think about times when you've had to deal with something that you thought was particularly hard or maybe even insurmountable, and the fact that you actually got through that successfully, you know, how did you do that? How are you thinking? How did you personally go about dealing with that? Because we can all be very different in terms of both our sense of control and ability to deal with these situations. So it is really important, I guess, to think about what's worked for you, and, you know, and listen to other people, of course, as well. So you can get really great information from the examples and experiences of other people in terms of how they've approached things and how they've overcome difficulties in whatever element of your or part of your life you're talking about there.
Can you talk to me a little bit about your involvement with Blue Ark and the experiences you've learnt from speaking with people who've been through bushfire and how they've recovered and how that's perhaps impacted their, you know, mindfulness in the event of future events like this?
So Blue Ark stands for Blue Mountains Animal Ready Community, and it's a community-led organisation, group that advocates for the preparedness and planning for animals in emergencies. And so it's a community to community approach to planning and preparedness, again with an animal focus, which is a great way to engage people in the idea of planning for any kind of emergency. We try and be very general in terms of what we're thinking about. It can be floods and storms, but of course in the Blue Mountains it is is largely driven by bushfire preparedness. So I've been involved in that group through my research areas, and as part of that research we surveyed the community in the Blue Mountains to both find out about their animal ownership characteristics, because that sort of information generally isn't sort of widely known, but also to look at their levels of preparedness and to look at the experiences they had going through bushfires, or they've had over time going through bushfires.
How have landholders' attitudes changed to fire and various emergencies, you know, after last year's season? And I guess maybe this is to help people sort of check in with where am I on that scale of mindfulness and awareness of my own preparedness, both mentally and physically.
You know, there's nothing like experiencing something big, either directly or indirectly, to make you realise what you could lose by not being more prepared or taking a slightly different approach to the way in which you may manage your land, or, you know, what you might do on particularly high danger days, if we're talking about sort of fire danger ratings, for example. So some of the people I've spoken to have had sort of near misses rather than being sort of maybe even directly impacted. And so it has been a great motivator to buy that new piece of equipment, or to have that discussion with a neighbour, or to think about how we might work together to manage fire, for example, on the property, and thinking what you can do collectively to do that, which of course can be really enabling, because then you're not alone. You're part of a team that's got to work through this problem, and that can really help, as can the broader conversations you can have in your own community, whatever that happens to be, whether that's a rural community with a single brigade that you could have a chat with in terms of how you might collectively think of better ways to cope. But I think thinking positively about what you can do and feeling that sense of control is really important from the point of view of feeling more able to handle those challenges if they do present themselves down the track.
Having a plan means we can be proactive with our response to emergency events. Linda Hanlon, who we heard from earlier, has experienced bushfires on her property, and having a plan meant she could act early.
So in 2013, which were the big fires in the Blue Mountains area that affected a lot of Springwood and Winmalee, I live in the Hawkesbury, I live out on a ridge, and the fire that started out the Lithgow Mines was forward spotting. So I was getting live embers landing at home, and I have a weatherboard house. So I decided to move my two horses out early. I think moving your animals early is the best thing you can do. Then you don't have to worry too much about them. You can then get your own stuff together. So I decided to move my two horses out. They were used to floating. My float was in good condition. It was registered. The tyres were inflated and everything was working. They load easily, even in a stressful situation. Animals can pick up on stress and anxiety, and they might behave differently than you think, and they might not load as easily as they would normally. So these two, they're used to being floated together, so I was able to float them down to the local evacuation centre. So I was able to sign them in, register them with the Animal Welfare League, and they went to a combined paddock at that location. Now, some people might not be happy with their horses sharing with other unknown horses. So I guess that's something you need to think about in your plan, is if you don't want your horses in with other animals and there's no stables available, you might find it better to have your own plan, which is what we're encouraging, is you have somewhere else that you take your animals and don't just rely on an evacuation centre or an animal safe place. We found that most people didn't realise how long it took to move their animals. If you had a half-hour trip in or an hour trip in, you've got to load up, pack all your gear with you, drive in, settle them in, and then go back. Have you got more animals than your horse float will carry in one load? Do you have to go back? Is there a chance that the RFS will shut your road or the SES will shut your road before you get back to pick up the remaining animals? So that's a big thing you have to think about. So moving early is a good thing. You might feel like it's a waste of time to get out, but it actually is a lot less stressful in the end if you actually move early. So I was lucky. There's nothing happened in those fires on my property. I was able to come back and look after the place and make sure all my gutters were, you know, any live embers, I knew what was happening with them around the place, but I knew that my animals were safe down at Richmond and I didn't have to worry too much. I needed to go back down there twice a day to feed them, make sure they're all okay.
Moving your animals early is important for many reasons. But what about those animals that stay behind on your property? How do we best plan for that? Linda Hanlon has some practical advice.
This is a hard thing, and it's a very difficult conversation as to what you do. The most important message is don't leave the front gate open, because it's going to become a danger for RFS or SES or people leaving their properties. If your animals are on the road, they could get hurt. So could the people who are trying to leave. So leave all your internal gates open so they can roam away from areas that might be impacted, but certainly leave the front gate shut. That's a really important message. Leave feed somewhere on a bare paddock. You could just plough a paddock or mow a paddock right down and leave feed and water in a non-flammable, non-melting water container. Just make sure there's enough water there. Another thing that a local St Albans RFS Fire Brigade has got some lessons learned from last year's, and they've put that on Facebook about what you do with your water tanks and your fences and your piles and, you know, do you have a mud map that you can put on your front gate that sort of shows the emergency services people what's there. So there's lots of little things coming up now that people are learning what to do in emergency and giving out suggestions for other people. So the question of leaving your animals, what animals you are leaving at home, if you've got small animals you can't take with you, leave them in an area where they've got water and food, in a room hopefully without windows, because heat can actually break the glass. And if you've got higher areas on your property, certainly leaving gates open so stock can go up into those higher areas is really important.
Following Linda's advice is critical for the health and safety of animals left behind. But what if they don't make it? Mel Taylor shares how it can be a real blow for landholders.
Some of the impacts that I've heard about from people in the rural communities has been actually the loss of things like working dogs, where the farmer has had a close daily relationship with the dogs that have helped him do his job. And you know, it's one thing to lose the cattle or the sheep, and obviously that's horrible, but losing the dog, that's been the tipping point.
The loss of a companion animal can be heartbreaking. But what about when you've lost a whole mob of animals, or some are injured beyond recovery?
Taking advice from people who've been through these situations to know that you have to make some decisions that may seem hard because there is a tendency to want to hang on to what you have, both practically and economically, but also emotionally, to think I've done my best to maintain what survived. In this case, we're talking animals. I think it can be really hard to make some of those decisions at that time when you've got so much to consider. So it can be really useful to have that sort of advice as well in terms of what is reasonable and what isn't reasonable. And to be given that, I guess, that assurance from someone who knows about this area and relieved of the mental pressure of thinking you've got to make your mind up on that, to be told this is really not in your best interest.
And when you think about taking advice from people who've been through this, you mean other landholders, but also vets who've had these conversations with other landholders?
There are people out there, you know, as you say, veterinarians who've been involved in helping people after these sorts of events, who've seen recovery or lack of recovery in certain animals and know the likelihood of a good or negative outcome. So I think being given, if you will, sort of permission to make a decision about, say, euthanasia in this case, I know it's a tricky subject, that I think that can be really useful and important and part of that healing process. Recovery is a long process. Yeah, if you're resilient, it doesn't mean you're not impacted. Everyone is different, and those recovery trajectories can be really different for individuals within households, let alone, you know, communities as a whole. And so the physical and practical recovery is one thing, and having things rebuilt and put back in place is one thing, but the mental recovery can be something quite independent of that.
Whilst the loss of animals during emergency events can take a toll, those that have survived can play an important role in building resilience, not only for landholders, but also for the land. One farmer who's experienced this firsthand is Aaron Brocken from Harvest Farms, based in Mount Tomar, New South Wales.
We run over two different properties, got a market garden and small apple orchard that I've been restoring down in Bilpin, and then up at Mount Tomar, and do a lot of other things like restoring berry orchard and also run some miniature goats and a few other things, spud paddocks, some garlic paddocks, all those good farming things.
Tell me a little bit about your experience being on the farm when the fires were coming through New South Wales in 2019, 2020, especially in the Blue Mountains area and coming up to you. What was that like, and how were you preparing for that experience?
Yeah, it was a culmination of things, really. Like, the drought was really hitting everyone hard, and I think everyone realised what was going on. And I think even in October, everyone could have told you that something was going to happen. The land was bone dry. the market garden was really on a nice edge in terms of the water that we had. It was a tough time indeed. And I think that really we were bracing ourselves in a lot of ways and preparing ourselves as best we could. You know, the property where I live is at Mount Toma, and then 5 minutes down the road where I have the market garden, were both at big risk. And I really had to make a bit of a choice about what I was going to stay and defend. And really it was here where I have the goats and I have a place to stay. I mean, it's never an easy choice. You know, no one wants to have to make that choice between what you have to save. And unfortunately lost, you know, shed and equipment and a lot of the apple orchard I'd spent a lot of time restoring down in Bilpin while I was up here defending. And then really, essentially, Mount Toma was burning so slowly, but still all around us for weeks. So it was really a matter of weeks of just constantly putting out fires and not really getting any proper sleep and whatnot. So that's a bit about sort of how the fire was. I mean, you don't really think about it too much when you're up here doing it. It's just what is what it is. You've lost used tools in your shed and irrigation and stuff, and you just try and jerry-rig something and because it was still blazing hot and it was still in the middle of the drought, you know. So you've got to try and keep your what you do have, your crops, your income and that alive while you're putting out and stopping your house from catching on fire. I don't want to put it on too thick because I know there's a lot of people here that had massive tragedies in the area too. The sense of community up here was amazing. All those sorts of things that you hear about. And I lost very little in comparison to some people up here, that's for sure.
Did the animals that you have on your land kind of influence any decisions that you made in terms of how you defended, what you defended, when you stayed and when you went, when you left the property and that kind of thing?
Yeah, for sure. I think anyone that has any livestock, that's your priority. I think even probably above your house for a lot of people, if you put an animal in a fenced area, that's your responsibility. You need to take care of those things. You know, that's, you worry about them the most, I would say. I'm speaking for a lot of people here too, but no one wants to see the animals get lost in the fire too. Now, I'd been sort of moving them around with portable electric fencing and managed to just sort of move them out of harm's way as the fire hit different areas of the property. But, you know, essentially I'd been using the animals to clear up scrub that was dangerous for bushfires for a long time on the property. So the goats are basically here in part to take care of the blackberry and a lot of weeds that essentially get out of hands. And when the fires hit, just blew up, you know, a 3 meter high blackberry bush is something that is quite dangerous in a fire. So for a lot of times, the animals had been there to help me sort of do a bit of a softer hazard reduction on the property. So yeah, essentially, to me it feels like they're part of my whole approach on the mountain. They're part of what I'm doing on the mountain too, and yeah.
And I just wanted to sort of flesh that out a little bit. What is the learning that comes out of that experience, and how does it shape farmers' actions moving forward? And I wanted to sort of talk to you about use of livestock as a hazard reduction tool. Can you talk a little bit about the thinking that went into that and the results you've seen, or, you know, just sort of sharing about the experience you've had?
I think anyone that's done a holistic management course or people that have started to read into this in any sense, I think it's about the difference between set stocking and leaving animals in a one fenced area as opposed to moving them around, is you do start to see improvement on the soil, and you do start to see basically species that you can control, the species that are growing in areas. And if you're constantly observing and monitoring what's going on and then adjusting your management systems around that, you know, regardless of the effectiveness of what I've done, I think it's important for people to look at it as a possible, you know, viable way to really reduce the bushfire danger on a property. I get a lot of joy out of moving them around through the bush, watching what they ate and observing the land. Now, having seen the fire already move through the place, you have a bit of a better idea about the path it's going to take and things like that too. What species of plants are going to be dangerous, which areas are of danger on the property. So it's essentially trying to improve the soils through the manures, rather, that are coming from the animal, allowing time for areas to regenerate, like moving the goats off of areas for months at a time, maybe even years, if that's what it needs, and just observing and moving them around too. I mean, you make a plan and you move them around to areas that you want to. It's heartbreaking because Mount Toma, obviously, I can look down over Bilpin and I could see everything burn in front of me. And then I can now look at it, and almost every day since the bushfire and since the fire ban stopped, everybody is pushing any bit of sort of scrub that's left on their property into a pile and burning it. And I understand people are scared, and I understand that there are different ways of managing things, and I'm not averse to using a bulldozer to clear out areas if need be. But it is heartbreaking to see that sort of management approach is the only management approach that people are taking at the moment to dealing with their fears and trying to come up with things. I think that there's got to be other ways, and I'm all for cultural burning too, and trying to understand those methods. But there's plenty of different methods we can use, and I've been finding this really effective and enjoyable.
You know, most people that I've come across who are landholders are quite pragmatic and practical people. So for those people, I think just having a list of jobs to work through and trying not to be overwhelmed in terms of, you know, how much you can achieve in a certain time frame, whether that's to do with cost or time, to be kind to yourself in realising you can't do everything sort of on the spot, but realising that every small thing you do will get you closer to where you need to be. You know, that incremental mindset, I think, is really important. So little and often can be a really positive thing. And I would sort of probably recommend that as a starting point, at least because you know what it's like. You know, you can get to that point where you can almost be paralysed because something just seems too big. And once you actually get involved and you start the process and you start the task, whatever it happens to be, it's much easier to kind of then keep going. So I think, you know, getting beyond that barrier is really important.
This podcast has been produced by the Grow Love Project on behalf of Greater Sydney Local Land Services. The episode was mixed and edited by me, Edgars Grester, and the executive producer was Susanna Cable. Thanks to everyone who participated in the making of this episode. You can find out more about them in the show notes. And to listen to other episodes, make sure to subscribe to the podcast. And if you know someone who could benefit, please share it with them. Thanks for listening.